This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The Pledge of Allegiance says that America is one nation under God, but not everyone feels that way. Surveys show that most of us do profess a belief in a higher power, mostly as Christians, but the Pew Research Center says about 6% of Americans say they are agnostic, unable to confirm whether God is real, and 4% identify as atheists, believing that there is no God. Other studies suggest those numbers could be much higher, but either way, both these groups seem to be growing. Now, this topic evokes really strong feelings and tons of questions. So, when we asked for your suggestions on conversations you would like to hear here, Nikki Gunn got in touch with us.
Hi, I'm Nikki from Indiana, and I submitted the topic Atheism in America because I feel with the increase of people who are now identifying as atheist or agnostic, humanist, or none, a conversation is needed to help introduce us. I feel there's still a stigma about it, and with more information, we can show that we aren't evil or gruff or have bad interpersonal skills. We are just people who care about our families and neighbors, communities, and the planet, but without a reward of an afterlife. We want to help make the most of our time here to help better the situation for our fellow humans. So thank you to everyone who voted for this topic and allowing this discussion to happen, and I'm really excited about the show.
We are excited about it too, Nikki. Thank you for the suggestion. And Nikki's idea kicks off our special series of listener-suggested programs. We're calling this one Ask an Atheist. We'll have more discussions suggested and chosen by you all this week. Now, everyone's experience with faith and doubt is different, and we'd love to hear yours. So share what you know or want to know about atheism or being agnostic or a humanist or a secular. Email 1A at WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us from San Antonio is Mandisa Thomas, the president of Black Nonbelievers Incorporated. Mandisa, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us from Pasadena is Kevin Bowling, the executive director of the Secular Student Alliance. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here with you today.
Here with us in studio is Amanda Poppy, the senior leader of the Washington Ethical Society. Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here.
And at Washington University in St. Louis, Lee Schmidt is a religious studies professor and the author of Village Atheists, How America's Unbelievers Made Their Way in a Godly Nation. Professor Schmidt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Professor, I wonder if we should begin with a few definitions, since there are a bunch of terms that may come up in the next hour. Let's just get them clear. First of all, what is atheism? What do we mean when we refer to someone who is an atheist?
Well, at a most basic level, it means someone who doesn't believe in God. The term, though, really started out not so much as an insider term, but one that you applied to your opponents. So it was a term of disparagement. So, you know, someone who was an atheist was someone who was immoral or just couldn't be trusted. So you would call an opponent an atheist. So if you didn't like Thomas Jefferson, you knew he was a bit of a religious dissenter, you would label him an atheist, or Tom Paine. So it was a term more of disparagement. And only in the middle of the 19th century did some people decide, look, if you're going to call me an atheist, maybe I'll wear the badge proudly. But many non-believers thought it was still too big of a risk to be known as an atheist, so they preferred some other terms that they thought had more ground for a constructive reading. So they might call themselves a secularist or an agnostic or just a liberal or a humanitarian. So all of those terms were seen as ones that weren't quite so controversial and quite so negative. So they... So those were some other options, and those options still float around today, of course.
So when we hear, Professor, when we hear someone talk about being a secularist, that's a kind of a synonym for atheist?
It is. It was first coined in the 1850s, and when it was coined, it was thought to be a way of saying, I want to focus on our what we have to offer constructively, what kind of morality we can agree on, what kind of reform programs we can agree on. And we don't want to emphasize the negative, that we don't want to simply emphasize the denial of God. We want to emphasize a positive secularist program. So yes, it's kind of a synonym, but it's seen as usually a slightly softer version, one that's more focused on the dialogue between believers and non-believers.
And before we get to some of our other guests' personal stories, I want to make sure that we've got this terminology correct: atheism, agnosticism, and so on. Joshua emailed, your initial discussion on atheism and agnosticism is incorrect, and many make the same mistake. Atheism, like theism, is a belief. Agnosticism is about knowledge. I am an agnostic atheist, and most people are agnostic theists. They just don't classify themselves as that. Professor, I'm a little dizzy in terminology right now. Did I get something wrong in describing atheists and agnostics?
Well, they're certainly close cousins. The agnostic wants to emphasize, and that term really comes up in the 1870s and 1880s, they want to emphasize that you can't know. And so the atheists, again, in that view, are just too positive in the declaration that God doesn't exist. The agnostic wants to put the emphasis on the open-endedness of this conversation. Got it. So, you know, it's a matter of degree. A lot of people would say by turn, sometimes they're an agnostic, sometimes they're an atheist. But that's basic difference is the agnostic wants to emphasize skepticism and uncertainty, and the atheist wants to be very clear about what they don't believe.
Let's work our way around the panel and understand a little bit more about how you define yourselves and how you came to that definition. Mandisa Thomas, let me start with you. How do you define yourself in terms of your belief or non-belief?
Well, I do identify firmly and clearly as an atheist. I do not believe in any gods, spirits, or supernatural beings. I would like to dissent with the person who emailed and say that I am open to new information of any kind, and that includes any God, spirits, or supernatural beings. I am not afraid to say I don't know, and that there's also a possibility that there could be some sort of entity of that is God-like.
Okay.
However, based on previous information as well as the lack of evidence of any God's existence, I will firmly state that I am an atheist and I do not believe in any of them. And it isn't just one God, it's all of them that have been reported throughout history and throughout folklore.
Right. Kevin, what about you? How do you describe yourself?
Sure. I think similar to Mandisa with the definition of atheism. I don't believe in gods, and so I think therefore I am an atheist by definition. I also look at, you know, how my values and how I live my life, and I very much identify as a humanist in that sense, and making sure that as human beings that we are responsible for living an ethical and moral life and helping, you know, our lives as best as we can be, but also helping better our communities and our world. And I think just to touch on that a little bit of secular, so I believe, you know, we live in a secular society, and so I also value that.
Amanda, what about you? How do you describe yourself?
I find that the term humanist is the one that feels most connected for me because it is that positive assertion about how we want to live our lives, about the worth of every human person and responsibility for the world resting in humanity. I will say I'm sort of that funny creature. I am a clergy person or a minister that serves a lot of atheists, folks who would say positively, just as Mandisa did, I am an atheist, I do not believe in God, and who attend a congregation on Sundays where I'm privileged to serve them.
What denomination is your congregation?
We are an ethical culture congregation, also connected with the Unitarian Universalist Association, which is a little bit better known. But ethical culture has been around since the late 19th century and is itself a humanist movement, essentially. Technically a non-theistic movement. So I'm going to throw one more term at you. Mm-hmm. Non-theism is not the same as atheism. I agree with folks. Atheism is the positive assertion there's no God, right? Non-theism, I like to say, especially because we're here in D.C., it means we have no official policy. So we leave those questions.
That's a very D.C. thing to say.
Right? Right? Yeah. Yeah. We leave those questions up to the individual. There are theists in the congregation. There are folks that identify as Christian. There are a lot of atheists in the congregation, a lot of agnostics, and what we come together around are shared humanist values.
We're speaking to Amanda Poppe, senior leader at the Washington Ethical Society, Washington University in St. Louis Religious Studies Professor Lee Schmidt, Kevin Bowling, the executive director of the Secular Student Alliance, and Mandisa Thomas, the president of Black Nonbelievers Incorporated. Lena emailed, I am a licensed minister. I always appreciate talking with atheists because we can throw out biblical references and debate purely on logic and reasoning. It's an exercise that always makes me think about my own faith with the eyes of those not of my own religion. If I can't give a reasoned thought about why I want a certain political bill to pass without religion, then maybe I have to rethink that bill. Amanda, I wonder how you'd respond to Lena, this idea of people of faith and people of no faith or less faith or questioning faith interacting.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I would say sometimes different faith, right? Like sometimes I think about, well, I've got faith in a lot of things, actually, human goodness and human possibility. But I love what she says, actually. And I think there's so many ideas that atheists are somehow immoral or as Nikki said at the very beginning, like grumpy or something, right? And in reality, we're folks just like anybody else. And in fact, we can all learn from each other. So I love that idea. And I love the idea of atheists having the capacity to gently and respectfully push more traditionally religious folks in their thinking that, you know, often we're actually smarter and wiser and better able to articulate our beliefs when we do so in some kind of dialogue with folks who have different beliefs. And if we can do that all respectfully and with care, everybody grows in that kind of dialogue.
Love to get some more of your questions and thoughts as we continue our conversation with Amanda Poppe, Kevin Bowling, Mandisa Thomas, and Professor Lee Schmidt. Glad to get your questions and stories, as well as your skepticism of the skeptics. Ted emailed, near-death experiences provide overwhelming evidence of an afterlife to skeptics. While I respect an atheist's position, they just have their heads in the sand. I'm not sure that's exactly respecting their position, but I am interested in knowing whether or not the skepticism has always been solid or whether there have been questions along the way. I'm Joshua Johnson, and I have faith that you will keep listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are answering your questions about atheism and agnosticism and secularism and humanism with Mandisa Thomas, the president of Black Nonbelievers Incorporated, Kevin Bowling, executive director of the Secular Student Alliance, Amanda Poppe, the senior leader of the Washington Ethical Society, and Professor Lee Schmidt, who teaches religious studies at Washington University in St. Louis. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well, your stories about belief or nonbelief. Comments on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. And we should note that the issue of labels came up very early on in some of your comments, particularly the labels for people who are just kind of no category religious people who are declined to answer. John left us a message about how he identifies.
This is John from Milwaukee. I take exception to the word atheism, as I see this as just another type of religious fundamentalism. I prefer to refer to myself as a-religious when asked. This at the very least leaves open the possibility that yes, there may very well be some type of universal supreme being, but at the same time, based on current evidence, as well as interpretations brought forward by humans thus far, rejecting all currently derived supreme beings.
John, thanks for sharing your thoughts through our app, 1A Vox Pop. Mandisa Thomas, I wonder how you'd respond to John.
Well, he sort of mirrored what I said in the first segment about being open to new information. I would disagree, though, that atheism is a religion. I remember the term saying calling atheism religion is like saying baldness is a hair color. It is a perspective. It is a point of view. Certainly it doesn't clearly define how we live our lives, even though to be an atheist from my perspective and the people that I've engaged, it means that it's just the start of a new journey. It means that we are not living our lives based on a divine premise, but what we have taken from the evidence and the world around us. And how do we navigate that from there? Letting go of the previous indoctrination and incorporating, like Kevin and Amanda said, more humanistic values. How do we care about our fellow, about our family, our friends, and the people around us without clear judgment, using the evidence that is there and also what has yet to be seen. And so it doesn't mean being an atheist doesn't mean you stop caring or you stop wondering. In fact, it actually increases that wonder and that knowledge and helps you care more.
Mm-hmm. Let me get to a few of your comments, and then I'd like to hear more about your spiritual journeys, Kevin Mandisa and Amanda. Christy emailed, "There are really some misconceptions about there by others. I work with someone who is a fundamentalist Christian. For some reason, he steered a conversation toward religion one day. At some point, he basically told me it was sad that I had no hope. Basically, his point was that you had to believe in God to have hope. That is crazy. I think that working every day to make the world, to help make the world a better place, gives me hope." Donna wrote on our Facebook page, "Religious people are fine as long as they don't presume that their faith gives them an inherent moral superiority. Atheists are fine as long as they don't presume their atheism translates to inherent superiority of intellect. I don't know why these puerile narratives persist within both groups, but they are equally tiresome." Kevin, I am interested in your reaction to Donna's point. That seems to be one of the constants that a number of people, at least that I know, have about interacting with atheists, whether they're people of faith or no faith, that there is something about some interactions with some but not all atheists that feels just like they're being evangelized, basically, that they are either... It's either that someone evangelizes you and says, "What's wrong with you for not believing in God?" or someone evangelizes you and says, "What's wrong with you for believing?"
I think you'll have that in both ways. And for non-religious people who live in, you know, in our society in the United States, which is predominantly religious in, you know, all of its institutions, there's a sort of a constant bombardment with sort of religious belief. And I think especially now within our political systems, I think a lot of people sort of feel that. And we are a country built on the separation of church and state, and we have seen that continue to be eroded. So I think people who are non-believers have that sense. And so, you know, I think there's a sense to defend that. What really, and we primarily work with students in the Secular Student Alliance, and really we work with them on working with people of faith and coming to understanding and having conversations and learning more about each other. We think we're you know, it's if the more we know about each other, the more we work together, the better our society is going to be. So we definitely encourage that. And I think we look at, you know, what sort of values we have, and it's inclusion and compassion, equity, sustainability, curiosity. And so there is a sense of learning and doing better in our world. And so those are important things for us.
We've gotten two emails from people with regards to your personal journeys that use the same phrase, coming out. One listener emailed, "I am a closeted atheist and I live in a very, very red state. My family are all evangelical Christians. What are your coming out stories and what advice would you give someone struggling with coming out?" Mandisa Thomas, let me back up and come back to you. How did you come out as an atheist?
Well, I will start with saying that I wasn't formally raised religious, okay, which is considered an anomaly, particularly within the Black community.
Yeah.
But I happened to come out with my atheism. I re-identified as an atheist in 2010 when I was 34 years old, and I found a community of online atheists. And that helped empower and strengthen my ability to openly identify, as well as get involved and start my organization. The advice I would have is, even if you cannot, and those are very understandable circumstances as to why you cannot be open with your identity, is to try and find, usually there is a either atheist or secular social group in most cities, even in smaller towns. So I would advise to look them up and reach out to them. Many of them will keep your confidence. Know that you are not alone in your journey, and that you are not alone in your atheism, and that there are people who can understand and help support you in that.
Before I come to you, Kevin, for your coming out story, Mandisa, can you dig a little bit deeper on this idea of identity? I hear the phrase coming out, and I take it seriously the way that I think our listeners meant it. I mean, but relating it to me, you know, I'm gay, and I had to go through coming out myself. And if I had not come out, I can concretely think of the things in my life that would atrophy or die in terms of finding love and sex and connection and affection and community and physical wellness. If you, Mandisa, were not able to openly identify as an atheist, what would be missing in your life?
I don't think I would be alive. I think it would kill me. I am not a person who suffers in silence well, and I don't encourage anyone to suffer in silence. And it is unfair and unfortunate that we still live in a society that would encourage people who are considered the other, whether you are LGBTQ or whether you are atheist or what doesn't fit into what is considered the majority. It is so unfair that people feel like they have to hide that for fear of retribution. And when we speak up, when we come out, our numbers increase and our strength increases, because then people understand that there are more of us out here and that we can combat a lot of the stigmas as well as a lot of the policies that seek to impede on all of our rights. And that includes many believers and as well. So we do have we can find out that we also have more in common than not. Mm-hmm. And it destigmatizes the atheism and that identity that has been considered to be negative for so long.
All right, Kevin Bowling, you've been waiting very patiently. Tell us about your coming out story. You said you describe yourself as an atheist and as a humanist. How did you come to those identities?
Well, and I grew up Roman Catholic with a strong Roman Catholic family. I was an altar boy for years, and so I have a lot of those religious in my background, and I still appreciate the ritual and the values that imparted on my life. And I think through college for me is when I started to realize there was a hypocrisy in the Catholic Church, and I'm speaking in generalities, and looking at sort of what the church talks about their values and then what they actually do. And so that led to my beginning to question, and through my coming out process as a gay man, that can sort of continue to further that process for me. And I think we look at, you know, many of our students that we work with, you know, sometimes it's easier in that sort of that coming out language, it's easier to come out as gay or lesbian to their families than it is as an atheist. I think for many people who identify as non-religious, helping, and I think you mentioned as well, sort of coming out gay, is finding that community and finding your people and finding people who have similar values to you. So that's sort of the atheist part. And we work with our students and we go like, okay, great, you're an atheist. You don't believe in God. You don't believe in God. Now what? Now how are you going to live your life? And that's really looking at some of those humanistic values, how you live your life. We have, you know, one life to live, so let's make it a good one. Let's make sure we're benefiting other people. We have one world, so let's make sure that, you know, while we're on this world, that we have a good life and that we're helping other people.
Kevin, before I come to Amanda, how much did you coming out as gay and you coming out as atheist dovetail or kind of fuel one another? Did one precede or propel the other?
I came out as gay first. And I think that was my primary identity. So, you know, I think you have identity and values. And so my identity as a gay man sort of coming out in that process, my coming out as an atheist, I think, was a much later process in my life. And I think for me, I sort of, the religion had much less importance in my life. And I then sort of led to, yeah, I don't really think that there's a God and this doesn't make sense. And where's the evidence of supporting this? And so looked for other things in my life of where I'm going to get my values. And, you know, and so those come from internally within me and wanting to make the world a better place and working with other people. So that's where my values came from and moving forward.
Before I get to Amanda, let me get to one email from Andy, who writes, "As an atheist, I find that many Christians assume that I feel this way because of some bad experience with religion. This is simply not true. I appreciate the interesting things that all religions bring to culture, but I find no empirical evidence for the existence of a God. The idea of a God is not even an issue that I ever think about without some reason like this." Amanda, you wanted to jump in.
Well, actually, that's a perfect lead-in, that email from Andy. So I have the unique position of, as I mentioned, serving a congregation that is full of atheists, not exclusively, but there's a lot of them there. And so, you know, as we were talking earlier about religion and whether atheism is a kind of religion or, you know, I have folks who are essentially religious atheists. If you think about religion as how you act, you know, what you do with your life, where you go on Sunday morning, how you raise your children, the rituals that you engage in throughout the year. That's what the congregation that I serve, the Washington Ethical Society, does. And we do it frequently for atheists. And I love what Andy said. I have a lot of folks in the congregation that actually had really positive experiences raised in a different religious tradition. And then over time simply realized that wasn't what they believed anymore. And they assumed that they then weren't going to be able to have the things that they had loved, the potlucks and the community and the experience of raising their children with their core values. I will say it is one of the most moving things for me when I get to sit in front of a newcomer to the congregation who says, essentially, I didn't think I could have this in my life. I thought that when I realized I was an atheist, there was no community where I would be able to be fully, authentically myself. To believe with total integrity what was being said on Sunday morning, and also have that sense of community and connection that you can have in a congregation.
Now, what are some of the rituals? Because I grew up Baptist, and then went to non-denominational churches, big mega churches for many years. What are some of the rituals that take place in your services? I'm used to prayers and scripture readings and a sermon and an offering and communion and so on. What's an average Sunday or Saturday or whenever you meet look like? Is it Sunday?
Yeah, it's Sunday.
Sunday. What
it's
is Sunday. It? What does a typical Sunday look like?
Yeah, so some of those elements would actually feel pretty similar, right? We do a collection. We actually share our collection with another organization every month. So we support local organizations through DC and around the country. There's something that looks a lot like a sermon. It's me often talking for 25 minutes. So, we call it a platform address or a reflection. We've got opening words and closing words. We sing together. We've got a chorus that offers music. We meditate. So invite people into introspection and silence and the experience of thinking about something larger than themselves. For us, that larger is, human community. It's our connection with the world around us. But the feeling, the need for that kind of introspection, for that kind of reflection, for community singing and community action and justice work together, all those needs are exactly the same for someone who identifies as atheist as they are for someone who identifies as theist. They're just going to fill those needs in slightly different ways.
Theist, meaning someone who believes in a God.
That's right. Exactly.
Professor Schmidt, I wonder how you see this phenomenon of atheism, maybe not a phenomenon, for these various secular communities in the U.S. versus other parts of the country. We're talking about, of course, America's connections to communities of faith or no faith. Is this the kind of thing that is just part of the human experience? Are there certain aspects of the U.S. that make our experiences with faith different?
Certainly compared to Europe or Canada or Australia, the United States is just a more religious country. I mean, when it comes to how much people pray or how seriously they take religion. So any of these humanist or atheist fellowships in the United States have that sense of being in the minority, being in some sense outsider communities. So that does make a difference. I mean, that context, that the premium Americans have for so long placed on religious belief, on seeing itself as a nation under God, that makes a huge difference for humanists, either as lone individuals or those who find themselves in community.
And it's been a strong part of our political underpinning, too, even just the effort to add under God to the pledge in 1954, right?
Right. So, yeah, in some ways, the 1950s, the Cold War are the high watermark for all of this. It's 1956, we decide that In God We Trust is the national motto as well. So that is the time in which non-believers in many ways feel the most marginal to what America believes in. But it's also the time when they start getting some legal traction at the Supreme Court level.
Much more to discuss as we continue with Professor Lee Schmidt, Amanda Poppe, Kevin Bowling, and Mandisa Thomas. I want to talk about this issue of evidence. We read that comment about afterlife experiences, the nature of evidence, how evidence and faith cohere, and whether you even need the evidence to be a person of faith. What does evidence mean in terms of your belief or lack of belief? We'll get to that and more of your questions and stories in a moment. Stay close.
Atheist.
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 Don't have no soul.
Christians have
their hymns and pages.
Hymns and pages.
Habanagila.
We'll continue in just a moment after a quick heads up about tomorrow's program on financial literacy. The partial government shutdown has a lot of Americans pinching pennies and dipping deep into their emergency funds. It is the kind of crisis that experts say all of us should be prepared for, but few of us actually are. If you learned to manage your money as a child or as a teenager, how were you taught? Was there someone or something that made a positive difference in your financial future? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Now, perhaps no one taught you, and you've paid the consequences for that. What should you have been told about how to manage your money? 855-236-1A1A. Or you can use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a radio quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. We will share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Mandisa Thomas, Amanda Poppy, Kevin Bowling, and Professor Lee Schmidt. We welcome more of your questions and thoughts as well. And boy, have you sent us so many. Thank you for the diversity of stories that you shared with us. But there's room for more. 1A@WAMU.org. I wonder about this issue of evidence. Ted emailed, near-death experiences provide overwhelming evidence of an afterlife to skeptics. While I respect an atheist's position, they just have their heads in the sand. Professor Schmidt, I wonder if I could start with you on this, partly because as a Christian, I was always taught through the scripture that evidence isn't the point. The Bible says faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. Jesus rebuked a crowd of Pharisees and said, "A wicked and adulterous generation looks for a sign, but none will be given." Why is evidence such a big deal in this conversation, especially for people of faith criticizing atheists? It just seems antithetical to scripture in a way.
It's certainly a way this issue then gets framed, right? I mean, because atheists put so much emphasis on having evidence on their side, it then puts more weight on the Christian side or the people of faith to have their own sense of how evidence works. I do think in Ted's example, near-death experiences is an interesting one because it does take God out of the picture and talks about other forms of experience, paranormal experience, And secularists can often be interested in, say, spiritualist phenomena. So questions around death and immortality open up places where secularists and religiously minded people have some interesting conversations and draw boundaries differently sometimes. But you're right. I mean, the evidence question is one that I think, since the Enlightenment, since the 18th century, it just so much emphasis gets placed on who can prove the point empirically, who has the evidence on their side. And I think you're right to point out that there are all kinds of ways in which people of faith might be better off avoiding that framing of the issue.
Mandisa, I wonder how you would respond to this. You had mentioned that you are an atheist, but kind of open to new information. I know there's that one big scripture that every Christian, especially new Christians, are taught. John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believed in him would not perish, but have everlasting life." The Bible is just saying all you got to do is believe. If you're looking for evidence, according to the New Testament, you're not going to find God if you're looking for evidence. Is it possible that in your search, or how comfortable do you feel in your search for information for your future, for information rather than just a moment of faith?
Well, it is because of my search for information, my love for information, being raised as a reader and looking at different not just the science programs and being a history buff, that I am solid in my ability to not just take something on faith, that anyone just encouraging me to just take something and just believing it simply because that should be the way isn't enough. And it also is damaging to the critical thinking process for not just ourselves, but also for our children. And that is something that shouldn't be encouraged. Now, as far as evidence, it takes a number of forms, and some in that I just mentioned. We look at the scientific method. We look at what can be what is replicated, and also what can be verified. I, as an individual, would never just tell you to just believe what I say. I will point you to a reference or references that will verify and back up what I'm saying. Now, as far as near-death experiences, I believe that I'm not an expert on that, but I believe there is an alternative explanation as to what happens to the mind when people are near death. And so if it can be explained by scientific or with data and phenomenon, then we can't just say that we definitely don't have our heads in the sand there. We are thinking about it.
I would say also, Amanda, the flip side of this, which is interesting, is this idea that although, you know, Christianity and the major beliefs depend on faith, there's also an element of scholarship that goes with them, too. I mean, the Bible also says, study to show thyself approved unto God. So you're not supposed to just go on faith blindly. You are supposed to know what you're talking about. Pew Research did a quiz some years ago and found that atheists and agnostics answered the most questions correctly about organized religion, more than people who actually practice those faiths.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And that's definitely...
Which is incredible.
Well, I think actually it makes a lot of sense, right? If you think about the idea that America tends to be a Christian country, right? That's the overwhelming experience. And many folks are raised with somewhere within the Christian tradition in America. That then if you kind of follow along in that, you know, and continue with what you were taught as a child, you don't necessarily need to do huge amounts of research to figure out what you believe or think. You continue with how you were taught. Whereas folks who begin to think differently often do go and kind of do the research, learn as much as they can, try to figure out where do they fit in. So I think it makes actually perfect sense that atheists and agnostics who are by their very nature in America, kind of bucking the trend, right, have spent a lot of time thinking about this.
And Kevin, there was a question I wanted to put to you, but before I do, I think I should get one more question to Professor Schmidt, which is relevant here. One of our listeners wrote on our website, the1a.org, is the conversation around atheism usually so Christian-centric? Professor, is that a function of us being in the U.S., or is that kind of the way it plays out in general?
Certainly the American context is an important part of that. It's very hard to talk about atheism here without thinking the major conversation partner or debate partner is Christianity. And that has been the case all along. In many ways, the whole secularist community in the United States, humanist communities, they take their shape from this relationship with Christianity primarily and then also Judaism. I mean, it's a way of thinking about yourself in that relationship. It's very hard to imagine atheism in the United States apart from its relationship to various forms of Christianity, whether it's a liberal versions or fundamentalist versions. They're just too close. They just shape one another so much.
Kevin, I wonder if you'd respond to this question from Sylvia, who wrote on our Facebook page, Christians, former Christians, and people of other faiths often talk about crises of faith or belief, which of course vary in magnitude, duration, and consequence. Have you ever experienced any type of crises of unbelief? Any large, disturbing what if that won't go away? Kevin?
I don't think I personally have experienced that. I think there's oftentimes when you're having conversations with the people where you're talking about what happens after life or near-death experiences, ghosts, spirituality. And so I think every once in a while you can have that question. And I think having that conversation and exploring that and learning and for knowledge sake is great. I think I'm still very much rooted in I don't believe in those things and I haven't found that evidence, and that's okay. And for people who do believe in that, that's fine as well. That's their beliefs and how they want to do that. So, but I do think for my personal life and how I, you know, what I find satisfying is looking more at what sort of evidence is out there and what sort of decisions I can base, what sort of evidence I can base my decisions on.
Amanda?
You know, I was thinking about this in the context of the folks that I serve in the congregation, and most of them would say that the question of believing in God or not is not the most important question to them. What's more important is how they're living their lives, how to create a more beautiful world. And so when I think about their crises of faith or of belief, it's not about, oh gosh, do I suddenly believe in God or do I not? Or it's about how can I live my life? People will come to me and say, I'm having a crisis. And the crisis is I have a relationship that's difficult and I want to figure out how to treat the person as well as possible. You know, I've got a family member I'm estranged from and how can I act well in this place? Those questions of belief or not, I think are so much really questions of the heart. You know, I mean, we can engage in scholarship both as believers and as non-believers, and that's interesting and important. But ultimately, what we believe is really where our heart leads us. And I haven't ever seen someone successfully argue people out of where their heart is. So for me, what's less interesting is that sort of debate around belief and more, well, how are we going to live our lives? All of us are asking those questions.
One of our listeners emailed, I am an atheist in the rural South. We're trying to start a local chapter of the NAACP. I was asked to lead a prayer. I believe that the person who asked was questioning my religious beliefs and testing me. So now I'm stuck with praying to a God I do not believe in or telling them I don't want to pray, which would not go over well. As a result, I've not gone to the last two meetings. Amanda, I see you shaking your head.
Well, I was just thinking, hey, email me. I'll write you a really nice atheist prayer.
An atheist prayer?
An atheist prayer, sure. You know, if you think about religion as functional, right? And prayer is something that invites us to think outside of ourselves and to think bigger than we are. I do a lot of work with different religions and justice work. So a lot of work in coalition with folks, often Christian, sometimes Jewish, sometimes Muslim. And I'm called to do this kind of thing all the time, right? To offer a prayer, something that invites us to connect together and to connect with something larger than ourselves, and to figure out how to do so with integrity, with my own beliefs, and also with an openness and a welcome to people in the room.
I wonder, could you end our show today with like a short atheist prayer? Can you do it in like under a minute?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
So I'll come back to you at the end of the program. But Mandisa, I'd love to get your reaction to this, particularly about the intersections between people of color and social movements. Desiree emailed, I am a black atheist. This question is for Mandisa Thomas. Can you speak to the unique perspective and challenges that black Americans who identify as atheist are confronted with? Mandisa?
So, yes. And this actually goes in line with the previous emailer about the NAACP. Mm-hmm. So within the black community, and this is according to Pew Research, the black community is among the highest of religiously identified. And we still make up a small percentage of the United States population. And the church has had such a pervasive influence within the community that it has become difficult for folks to separate the two. That if you are black, then you absolutely must be religious in some way. And to let that go means that you are rejecting your blackness, that somehow you are trying to be not a part of the community. And so that is an additional challenge that we have being black or a person of color, and especially as it does tie into social justice and racial justice actions. Many people don't remember that one of the founders of the NAACP, W.E.B. Du Bois, was a freethinker. He identified as a freethinker. There is a history of humanism and atheism within the black community that tends to be vastly ignored. And it is time for us to start reminding people of that. There has been such a religious privilege within the black community in particular that it has obscured the presence of of activism on behalf of people who identify as secular and atheist.
I know our time is short, but I want to get to one more response, Kevin, from a different John who left us a note. Here's what the other John left in our inbox.
I have a lot of friends who are atheists and a lot of friends who are Christian as well. And I've noticed a tendency of some of my atheist friends to be more dedicated evangelists for their beliefs or for their absence of beliefs than most of the Christian ones. And I was wondering, what causes people to be so dedicated and devoted to the absence of a belief?
Interesting question, John. Kevin, what would you say to him?
Well, and I think we live in a society where it's in the United States, where it's somewhat automatically presumed that you are a person of religion. So for someone who is not, you sort of have to defend your stance a little bit in that sort of overwhelming pervasiveness of religion in our society. So I don't think that's intentional, but I do think for people who are, you know, constantly feel that pressure, they have to stand up for that. And we work with our students in having interfaith panels, and so we can learn from each other. We have in our Secular Student Alliance and college universities across the country, we have students of religion who are actually members because they want to have these conversations and discussions. And our students love and embrace that. So having those conversations. So that's somewhere where someone, you know, a person of religion is coming in and sort of seeking knowledge and seeking information. And again, I don't think in most cases we change minds, right, but we have a greater understanding of each other. And so I think that's coming from a very good place when I don't think oftentimes people non-religious feel that coming from a good place in our general society.
So before we adjourn, let us end now with an atheist prayer. Amanda, you ready?
I am.
Can you do it in about a minute? All right, away you go.
I want to invite all of the listeners, believers and non-believers and believers in many things, to join me in a spirit of reflection. To bring your hearts, whether your heart this morning is broken and hurting or alive and full, to bring your heart into this moment. To take a breath. Feel your lungs fill with air. Let it out and know that the other listeners around the country are breathing in and out with you. As we bring our hearts and our breath and our bodies and our minds into this moment, we commit ourselves to building the kind of world where all of those hearts and breaths and bodies and minds are welcome. Where we together enter into dialogue and beautiful justice building with each other. May that be so.
Amanda Poppe, Senior Leader of the Washington Ethical Society, Kevin Bowling, Executive Director of the Secular Student Alliance, Mandisa Thomas, the President of Black Nonbelievers Incorporated, and Professor Lee Schmidt of Washington University in St. Louis. This conversation was produced by Jonquilin Hill. To learn more about JQ and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.